Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on a serious issue. We invite people who have contributed something to the mastery of their field as independent thinkers, creators, philosophers, healers. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, Biocognitive Sciences, how our cultural beliefs and the environment that we grow up in contribute to our immune system, our aging, longevity, wounding, and healing. My guest is Dr. Mario Martinez. He is a clinical psychologist specializing in psychoneuroimmunology and anti-aging. 15 years ago, Mario developed the theory of biocognitive science and psychology, which is a mind-body theory that explains how thoughts and their biological expression co-emerge within a cultural environment. He is the founder of the Biocognitive Science Institute in Uruguay. And there he conducts research and offers training in biocognitive principles. He's written numerous articles and research papers. He authored The Mind-Body Code, How the Mind Wounds and Heals the Body. Part of his theory emerged spontaneously, and also his understanding of phenomena such as stigmata. And he worked with spontaneous healing for the Catholic Church, and also he worked on private cases, and we'll get to stigmatas later. His website is biocognitive.com. Nice to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure to be back, Gary. Thank you for inviting me.
Because we have thousands and thousands of brand new listeners every day to this program, over 1,800,000 new visits just in the last 12 months. That doesn't include all the older listeners who've been listening for a while. I want to give a little extended introduction and then ask you to go into this in depth. Don't worry about taking too much time. I'd much rather have this used as a classroom on the air than anything else. I plan to discuss some other topics we have not addressed on this program. But for the new listeners, I'll need you to begin by defining the concept of biocognitive theory and explain what is meant when you say that cognition and biology, including our genetic makeup, co-merge within a cultural history. So let's begin by speaking on that, please.
Okay. First, the best way to frame this is to look at what happens with the different disciplines. There, what was going on and still going on is that, for example, a discipline like psychoneuroimmunology, PNI for short, studies how thoughts and emotions affect the regulation of the immune, nervous, and endocrine system. They come up with some very interesting and exciting discoveries. Then you have anthropology on the other side, which actually studies cultures in depth. It studies the conceptual cultural concepts of health and wealth and aesthetics and all the things that are related to what we are as a culture. Then you have neuroscience, which studies how the brain works and unfortunately had been studying, or in some cases they still do, how the brain works when it breaks, when there's damage. So those three areas were coming up with discoveries, but none of them really converging in a way that you could put it together and let an audience know, okay, the mind is related to the body, and they're inseparable, but the culture is also inseparable. So I created, as you mentioned, biocognitive science, which really brings together psychoneuroimmunology, cultural anthropology, and especially what's called cultural neuroscience, which actually studies the healthy brain. And by studying the healthy brain, we found some incredible things that actually bring tremendous sense of hope, rather than being a bimodal on or off. There's a multitude of functions that the brain has that cannot be studied if you just look at the breaking or functioning component of it. So that's a kind of in brief, that's how I came about it.
Okay. You were a student, or at least a major admirer, the late Chilean neuroscientist of body-mind relationships, Dr. Francisco Varela. Now, he was exiled
yes, he was
from
a colleague and a friend.
He was exiled from Pinochet's movement, his coup, and he was the first who introduced the concepts of neurophenomenology and molecular cellular cognition. And Varela was also a very devout Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. He was a close friend with the Dalai Lama. And he was a major influence on the work of the late Professor Lynn Margulis of the University of Massachusetts. Now, I don't believe many listeners would have heard of Dr. Varela. So I felt that rather than repeat anything from the general information out there on him, that since you were close to him, you could begin by briefly introducing his work in the context of your own research that led to your developing your biocognitive theory. And then please speak about this interwoven, interdependent relationship between our body's local pathways, such as our immune system and our nervous system and our endocrine system, with the non-locality of the bioinformational field. And also explain the bioinformational field and how does this interrelationship then become manifested in our cultural history and setting. Now, it may seem a little complicated for the audience, but please bear with us. I believe in creating the large picture by putting the individual pieces together. In about 5 minutes now, when we get into actual examples, for example, someone who says they're filled with love, but everything they do shows not love, and someone who says they're spiritual, but in their day-to-day lives, they're not spiritual. And people say they want health, and everything to do shows that they're promoting disease. And people show that they want security in an authentic way, and yet everything they do is risk security and become volatile emotionally. We've all met these people. And so there's two stories they're telling us. One, the story they try to sell us, their story. But then when we get close to them, we see there is a completely different person. And it doesn't match the story we've been told. Are they not aware of this? Are they disconnected? This is where I believe we can learn so much from the idea of neurophenomenology and cellular cognition based upon how that person was influenced growing up and the reactions they had to parental figures. So be a little patient. You'll see where we're going. Would you please address these in?
All right. I'll start with what you were asking first with Varela. Francisco Varela was one of the few, as you said, he fled when they were with the coup and the dictatorship in Chile. He was a PhD from Harvard, and he was one of the first who actually this has been going on from the beginning of time, but one that began to formulate that, as he called it, that the mind is not in the brain. And he began to talk about the fields of information, that yes, the brain is the portal where the information is expressed intellectually, but it doesn't mean that the brain is the intellect of the body. It's constantly communicating with the body with what I call the bioinformational field, which is a field of information within living beings. And then he started studying how these things affect immunology and endocrinology and especially phenomenology. Phenomenology studies mental processes, but it had been basically discarded with behaviorism, which actually was looking at just stimulus response and what they call the black box, which it doesn't matter what you're thinking. It's just the stimulus and the way you respond. Well, so it lost a lot of credibility, but Varela was able to actually create scientific models that you could actually, and this is, as you mentioned, from the Tibetan Buddhist psychology, he was able to extract quite a bit. They are scientists of the mind, and their research is as rigorous as doing microbiological research, but it's different. It's phenomenological research in the first person, the other one's in the third person. So Varela was very inspirational in that sense, in breaking away from the conventional reductionist way of looking at things. And an example Because I think, as you said, you go from the general to the specific. An example of how to break and how to see the difference between the how the reductionist system works and how it doesn't apply to human beings as well. If your car, say you, your car has a leak in the gas tank, well, then the solution is to fix that leak whether you're in Brazil or in Brooklyn. That's it. It's a reductionistic, linear process. If you apply that with human beings, it doesn't work as well because we're more than parts and our context is very important. So what would be an example? If you have what would be called anemia, which is a really good example of the break this down, bringing anthropology in, and especially pernicious anemia, which is a deficiency of B12, and you treat it with B12 in a Western world. Well, you would think, just like the car, you treat it the same way no matter where you are. But if you go to the Bolivian Andes, where they have shamans that are called they're Aymara shamans, the shaman interprets that culturally as limpu. He calls it limpu, which is, according to their beliefs, if you watch a stillbirth, the spirit of that child will possess you and will consume you to be able to stay on earth. Well, what does that happen? What does that do? An authority saying that within that culture, within that collective belief, and both the Indians or the indigenous of the area and the mestizos, which mixed with Indian and white, will die if they have a limpu or in the Western world anemia. Now, the interesting thing is not only that they can die by a symbol, but the white Bolivians in that region, because they identified with their Western ancestry, will not die from limpu. They would be treated by a Western doctor with B12, and they would be cured. But no amount of a Western intervention would cure that person because their bioinformational field, their biosymbols, symbols creating biology, will not allow them to trigger that healing that can occur when you give somebody B12 with a deficiency. Well, that's one of the good examples of really looking at, we're not cars, and we can't be fixed in one place and another independent of the context. So then gradually I was able to look into why is it that anthropology and psychoneuroimmunology are not looking at each other's? Because although psychoneuroimmunology has elegantly shown that our mind and our body are interrelated, that our emotions are interrelated with how the immune system functions and so forth, they're doing it without a context, without a cultural context. And we find that, for example, you can have honor is an emotion that goes counter to the inflammation caused by shame. If a person is shamed, they would have some inflammation. The immune system responds as if there's some kind of wound or infection, and you actually have inflammation. But honor and shame are very different in one country and another. So, for example, if you are in an Eastern culture and you're shamed, you're not going to be shamed as an individual. The shaming comes from you having shamed your group. So, therefore, if they try to shame you without involving the group, you don't have as much of a reaction of the inflammation as if in the United States, which the shame is very individualized, then the shaming would cause more inflammation. And you know, and as we go on, I can give you much more examples, but the idea is that it's interrelated, it's inseparable, and it's very, very hard science. This is not just something that somebody invented in kind of new agey wishful thinking, but hard science has been studied and has been replicated for the last 40 years. Why doesn't it get to the public? First, because of what I mentioned of the disconnection between the disciplines, but also is that it's not something that would be viable in an economy that looks at people as if they were mechanical beings and biochemical beings. So therefore, it doesn't have the power in the marketing that could be done if we could shift the paradigm. Although, I think because of the economic reasons, people are moving out of the conventional reductionist medication model and moving at other kinds of things. Not alternative, but integrative. I don't think alternative is the way. I think it has to be an integration because medicine has made remarkable discoveries and remarkable methods in treating infections, in emergency room trauma, a variety of things that are really powerful that cannot be dismissed. But at the same time, you can't just rely on that reductionism, because we're not machines. We're living beings that can regulate ourselves and that are very, very context sensitive, and more than that, culturally sensitive. And what's a culture? A culture, the way I define it, is very simple. A culture has three codes of identity. First, inclusion. What do we include in the culture? If you're an American, then you are part of an American culture or subculture. What do we exclude? People who are not from the country in terms of nationality. And the third one is communication. What do we communicate? Well, mostly English, and of course there's subcultures and so forth, but those are the three basic codes that we have. And by the way, immune cells also have those codes. A T cell identifies what it is, a T cell, what's not a T cell, and how it communicates with other T cells and other subcultures. So it's really something that works from the molecular, cellular, all the way up to the belief systems that we have in what the world should be or what it is.
I appreciate those insights. Mary, I'm going to share a different point of view on a few of these issues and get your feedback, all right?
Okay.
I believe that we have it just backwards, completely backwards. I believe that 88% of all orthodox medicine has failed to meet even the basic criteria of safety and efficacy. Yet 12% has, mainly emergency medicine. If you have a severed finger, if you have a gouged eye, if you have a broken tooth, if you are in a hospital for a heart attack or a stroke, medicine works at a terrific level. But for all other care, it is not only not supported by any quality science, it actually is the number one cause of death. I've written an extensive article on this and was sent it to every scientific publication in the United States, 8,000. And it is the number one cause of injury. To give you an idea, in the last 10 years alone, more than 6 million people have died trusting completely in orthodox medicine. I'll go one step further. Angelina Jolie, for whatever her reasons, and I don't believe that we will know that completely, she decided to have completely normal, healthy breasts removed, based upon her being concerned about testing positive for the gene expression of the gene that we're told will cause cancer of the breast. The lack of common sense and reason is palpable in that. Not only hers, but clearly the people that advised her. It will not cause other forms of cancer in the body, so you get your breast removed, but then you could have cancer of the stomach. She has a history, public history, and acknowledged drinking drugs. Well, that causes other cancers as well. That substantially depresses the immune system. She's had a lot of issues. As a result, she's not protected from heart disease, from arthritis, from inflammation. So what is she going to do? Remove her brain so she won't get Alzheimer's from all the damage down there? Remove her liver or kidneys? There's a disconnect here. And yet she was perfect in what she suggested, what she did, and what is she now promoting as a spokesperson for women empowering themselves. This is actually the disempowerment of women. Our entire medical model disempowers women. How? A, it promotes pregnancy as a disease. It is not. It promotes childhood as a disease, a pathology to be defined and by medical testing. Your profession is responsible for this. It is not. Children are not inherently defective because of how they emotionally express themselves. Yet today we're told that if a child cries and laughs, they have bipolar. Absurd? Yes, but not in how serious they take it, because the public is more likely to be accepting that, as the medical community has not defended the patient. Name me one great strike that doctors in America, 900,000 strong, have done on behalf of their patients. You can't name it because it doesn't exist. Only what benefits them. So, when they were given their female patients synthetic hormone replacement therapy, and all the studies showed an increase by 13% minimal heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, dementia, and colorectal cancer, you would have thought that people offering something that was scientifically invalid and harmful and no efficacy would have defended the woman and healing. Yet shamans, natural healers, naturopaths, homeopaths, osteopaths, chiropractors, nurse practitioners, all were promoting a more natural way of healing. So I think that we should first start off by asking, what is healing? How does healing manifest? What is necessary in the healing process? And then integrate that with what we can prove works. The so-called science of vaccination does not impart immunization. I have a brand new documentary coming out. I just finished filming over 52 of the world's leading women scientists on this subject. Not one of those scientists would state that vaccination imparts immunization in a given individual. It may produce antibodies, but it can't be shown that those antibodies are protective in any given person. So when we look at how abusive medicine has been, but it is officially recognized, and I would say that official medicine suffers from the very condition that you were suggesting, like the bone pointing in Aboriginal cultures. You do something wrong that they consider egregious, they point a bone at you, you go out in the desert, 2 days later you're dead. And as you say, someone can die by the belief in something. I say that an entire medical industrial complex at $3 trillion a year has lorded over all other natural forms of healing, has dismissed it, denied it, denigrated, attacked it, and even kept it from having any legitimacy and thrown its practitioners historically in jail. And so shouldn't we first ask, who's actually healing people? Who's preventing disease? We are. What have they done? What has the Surgeon General done, the U.S. Public Health Service, the FDA, the CDC, to prevent any disease? They haven't. Who's been first and foremost in talking with truth about what causes disease, both physical and mental and spiritual? We have. Who has only been there palliatively to give some medication? They have. It's what Eric Hoffman, you know who Eric Hoffman, then I'll shut up. He said, when people are free to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. I see most of the so-called healing in the United States a gross mechanical insult to the true healing process. It is just a series of mimics. Your thoughts, please.
Well, no, I think that that's a very legitimate statement that needs to be made. Iatrogenic medicine, which, as you know, is the intervention itself causing harm, is number one. It's very difficult to measure, but it's very high. One of the situations with medicine is that it's excellent with acute problems, but it has failed miserably with systemic problems. And the reason for that is that, and this is why I introduce the concept of the learning of an illness. Medicine does not consider that an illness is learned. It considers that once you have a critical mass and it shows up, then you have to either attack it, remove it, without a consideration that there was a learning process. The immune system learned, the nervous system learned, the endocrine system learned the things that we're doing by the culture beliefs, by the lifestyle, by the environment, are learning. So one of the things that happens when people have these very intrusive preventive surgeries, one is that in the case of Angelina Jolie, as you mentioned, what they found was a mutation of a gene that only accounts for 10% of the cancers. And second, the other thing that happens, as you said, is it could happen at other organs, but the most important thing is that it gives the person a false sense of security. Since she had her breast removed, then she's free to not concern herself with anything else. So what happens is the lifestyle doesn't change as much, and the things that actually are related to what's called a C personality, which is the propensity for a personality that's a greater propensity for cancer, are not considered, are not looked into, and then the person later doesn't know what happened when they get sick. They ask themselves, well, here's my insurance, and where's the warranty, where's the guarantee, and it doesn't work. So it's really sad that some physicians are willing to do things like that without really giving scientific evidence that what they're doing is actually preventing anything. It's a probability event, and probability events are basically chances that you take. So it's really important to be able to not just criticize something, but come up with alternatives. And the alternatives are that we have to begin to look at how we are born and what we come from. We are basically, the way that I look at it, is that I see that illnesses are learned and the causes of health are inherited. We inherit the causes of health, the probability and the potential to be healthy. And then we learn to get sick, with some exceptions of gene problems with mutations and so forth. But most of it is learned. Most of it is a learned process of how we live, what we do, the beliefs that we have. A symbol could stop the heart with a parasympathetic reaction if you're told that you're going to die because a spirit is inside you. If you believe, for example, some of the voodoo beliefs or other cultures. And how can then a symbol, how can a word then have a biological consequence? And the reason is that that word started having consequences the day we were born, with the sounds that we heard, the authority figures that we had in our lives that told us don't go out in the rain because you'll catch a cold, and you'll catch a cold because what you're doing is you're suppressing immune function because rain equals danger. So we can't look at it at the end. We have to look at it at the beginning, that we learn all these symbols and they become biosymbols as our perception is embodied, and then those symbols will have a nocebo or a placebo effect.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Mario, I'm going to throw several issues at you simultaneously. Please choose any that you would like to address. I think they're all relevant. Okay?
Okay.
I believe
all right. One example of the misunderstanding of a conduct that's not popular or that's difficult to manage, misunderstanding that and giving it a pathological etiology and giving it a pathological name and treatment and spending billions of dollars on it is the attention deficit disorder with or without hyperactivity. I do not consider that as a deficit. And I do not consider it that it is a disorder. I'm coming from a neuropsychological point of view. It is an abundance of curiosity that the usual classroom environments cannot handle. So therefore, the child becomes deviant in the sense of not being able to pay attention. But you notice that you see a child with attention deficit disorder and with hyperactivity or without it, and you give them a video game, and all of a sudden, the hyperactivity is gone. Why? Because you increase the curiosity. And there's some arguments that will say, well, we know that what's happening is that there's a drop in dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter, and yeah, there is a drop in dopamine. But the reason is that dopamine drops when there's a greater need for curiosity. It drops when there is a greater need to explore. Because since the dopamine is the reward system for discovery, when you start making discoveries on the outside, then you don't need as much dopamine. Dopamine drops. So what do you do with a situation like that? You increase the curiosity in a controlled way. And then the argument is, well, but we can't be giving constant novelty to a child. True. What you do is you first teach him to increase that novelty, interesting novelty, and then you teach them to internalize that novelty so they don't have to be constantly climbing the walls constantly. But you see, it's a misinterpretation of a situation. And rather than seeing that it is a curiosity abundance, they see it as a deficit of attention, and then it's treated with the stimulants, and it's treated with the medications that have terrible side effects. And what it does is it increases the dopamine. And as it increases the dopamine, it dopes the child. That's a, you know, kind of play on word, but that's what happens. So the child is not willing to pay more attention. Since the child, you have dropped the need for abundance of curiosity, then what appears to be that they're paying attention is that they don't have as much curiosity.
Okay. Today, on one of my programs, I read an extensive commentary on the death of liberalism by one of the classic liberalists in the United States, Jeffrey St. Clair of Counterpunch. And in this brilliantly insightful commentary, he talked about the fact that you don't see the liberals out there with major marches against the war today or against the National Defense Authorization Act. Individuals, yes, but not as a group. The unions, forget it. And he's going through all the different people who historically would have been the first when there was an assault against liberties, rights, freedoms, when tyranny and fascism had raised its head, both of which are absolutely dominant right now in the body politic of the United States with so much corporatocracy. And then I offered a completely different perspective. That's why if people want to listen to it, it's on the archives. I was not in denial at all of what he said. He was completely correct. Liberalism is dead, completely dead. And that which is still out there is like a zombie. It doesn't know what to do. It's not organized. It's not cohesive. They're not working together. And then what you have in its place, these are the traditional liberals. What you have in traditional liberalism is those who see that life is more than a body politic. You can't define all of life through a political ideology. And unfortunately, that's what's happened to many. So then you have the corporate liberals who, like Clinton, the Clintonites and the Obamaites, they're just going to go along. But then I said, why don't you take a look at over the weekend, between 2 and 3 million people, not the liberals, not the Democrats, no political agenda, but rather one based upon fighting for our rights of freedom of choice when it comes to food, marching against Monsanto. Now, which organization, think tank, put this together? None of that. A woman named Canal from California who became frustrated about what was happening with genetic engineering. We played our part. I showed seeds of death, and in just hours, 57,000 people downloaded it. And how many have seen it now, I don't know. We gave articles out. People from this audience attended more than 457 different demonstrations. So on the one hand, no one's paying attention to what the progressives and the independents who are looking at problems differently. We're still caught into this idea that if you don't see any change in the dynamics you're looking at, you think no change is occurring. What about all the people that have stopped buying anything from a box store like Walmart, stopped banking in their banks, stopped watching their ads, stopped using their medications they see on television where the side effects could be death, like the allergy medication, the sleeping medication, the heart medication? All the side effects can lead to death. They don't see the people going to the farmer's market, the people who are caring for their children in a different way. They don't see the spiritual renaissance that's actually occurring, the environmental efforts that are occurring, all at the grassroots level. There are no major leaders for these. It's something that's really unique. That said, how do you define American cultural standards today within the context of biocognitive characteristics of this culture? And especially when you don't have a single culture in the United States, we have at least 8 different cultures. We have the teen culture. We have the college to 35 culture. We have those over that. We have the family culture. We have those who are, their whole purpose for living is to get financially secure. So they'll do anything, spend any amount of time, effort, sacrifice their relationships. They'll do anything to get ahead. And then once they finally get there, it wasn't what they thought it would be and wasn't enough. And then you have all these crises, but the official groups that historically had been responding aren't. Now, wasn't it Dante who said the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in the time of the greatest moral crisis, maintained their neutrality? And I yes. attest that the entire medical community in America, with few medical doctors, have maintained neutrality when they've seen the false, fraudulent, completely perverse and pornographic diagnosing of ADD and ADHD. They have refused to acknowledge the relationship between environmental factors, including vaccines and their ingredients and adjuvants like aluminum or mercury, and the epidemic in autism. They have refused to look at the relationship of stress and disease. In fact, actually pandering to the notion historically that there was nothing in your diet that mattered. It was official policy. It was in the official context of their treating that outside of kwashiorkor and marasmus, diet didn't matter, that emotions didn't matter, that the older you get, the less exercise you should do. So you start looking at how powerful that belief is and how it's passed on, and then how powerful it is when people are part of that because people are afraid to challenge authority figures. Wasn't it Rollo May, the great psychologist, who said, hate is not the opposite of love, apathy is? And where we talk about love, aren't we really showing apathy? Aren't we showing neutrality? Aren't we showing indifference at every single thing that we should be moved at? When was the last time you saw a demonstration to stop home foreclosures? There's been, are you ready for this? There's been 11 million. When did we tear up our credit cards and tell the banks, you got your money for free, why are you charging us 18% to 30%, and then if we're late, up to 200%? When did we see a demonstration against the Democrat and Republican Party, both corrupt to the core, from the White House down? They're pimping for major corporations. Instead, we turn our backs as a nation on the independent and progressive people like Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, Gary Johnson, Dennis Kucinich, and Ralph Nader. That is what I'm talking about, and I believe that that is in part due to what you are looking at and researching in biocognitive therapy. Could you explain that, please?
Yes, I will give you some good news, Gary. Just as you're seeing those that silent revolution, that very modest revolution where people are beginning to break away and beginning to take that consciousness and that mindfulness about that they are the first step to change. The same thing is happening with a subgroup of people that I am working with and that I'm seeing, for example, in a very modest way. In Uruguay, we have trained over 40 or 50 psychologists and physicians who are sick of doing things the way they were trained to do it, and now they're practicing with methods of biocognition and mind-body methods, and actually are getting better results, and they're getting more patients because these patients are just as upset as they were, and we've done it in Ireland and some in the United States, so there's a move, at least from what I'm seeing, of professionals also getting fed up with what they learned. What I learned in neuropsychology is 10% of what I use now, completely different. So I think that there's a movement, but what happens is that in that movement, we don't have the media, we don't have the marketing power to be able to get that information out to the public, so it appears that nothing's happening. But I can tell you that I'm very pleased to see that people are professionals are moving in that direction. I go to conferences where I went to a conference in Cuba where it was just Caribbean and South America where people are talking about these mind-body alternatives or integrations. I've been to the conferences in Buenos Aires and other areas where actually these things are happening and they're hearing what we're talking about when we say that we're not just machines, when we say that medication is not the only answer, and in some cases you need it, but this is for acute. No medication was made for anything other than acute. There's some exceptions. If you can't produce beta cells for insulin, then of course you're going to be insulin dependent. But even that, there are ways to minimize the medication. We have worked with type 2 diabetes, teaching people that it's not just the deregulation of glucose, but there are many other things that are going on that they have control over, in addition to diets and other ways of looking at things, that, for example, modulation of anger, modulation of control, there's a tendency to be over-controlling, all those things that you have power over. But what happens, though, is that once you empower someone, then they don't need a lot of the a lot of the economy. So when I work with centenarians all over the world, centenarians would hurt the economy because they eat healthy, they don't eat a lot, they hardly go to doctors, and I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just saying I'm reporting what I see, and these people are very internal control. They're very happy with very little, and they can be very wealthy or they could be very poor, but they're very happy with very little. I've met centenarians who are multi-millionaires, but yet they had the simplicity, the humbleness, and the needs that were so clearly stated as internal rather than external. So they didn't buy into the system of constantly being a consumer. So getting back to your question about how I see the American culture, of course, as you said, it is a multicultural process. But there's a it's kind of a what's called a hegemony, which is that the culture, the leading culture or the culture with the power, controls the other subcultures in such a way that you see it as reality rather than one reality. And one of the examples of that is the American dream of working very hard and then retiring to go to Florida. The status is based on the size of the car and the home and so forth. And all of those things work against longevity. Work against longevity because you're living a life for a future rather than living a life for the moment to be with the people that you love. One of the best immune enhancers that you can find, very simple, having dinners with family without television, without any disruption, and actually talking to each other. That's in our DNA. That comes from the time of the caves, where eating together was a form of survival. Well, now it's not survival, but in a way it is, because what do? We have dinner with our television sets. We don't talk to each other. The kids are playing with the video games, and there's no interaction, which the immune, nervous, and endocrine system, we're made to have that interaction. We're social beings that constantly have to be interacting in a quality of time type of thing. And what do? We go work out, and we work out hard, and we play hard, and we eat hard, and everything we do is not modulated. It's not made to how the nervous, endocrine, brain, and other systems were made. They're made to interact. They're made to have modulations. They're not made to be working as a machine. One of the things that I teach when I work with corporations that are truly interested in the health of their employees is that I teach them to plan their wellness when they're planning their quarterly productivity objectives. And at first they think, what do you mean plan our wellness? Well, you're planning the numbers that you want in 4 months. What is the process of the wellness that you're going to plan so that you get there without getting sick and not at the expense of the wellness? And unfortunately, most corporations work, and here's the interesting thing. You have all the things that you think would keep you healthy. You have the daycare. You have the nice office. You have the good food, vacations, good salaries, the gyms, all those things, and yet we have such a high level of chronic illnesses in the corporate world. Why? Because what's going on is that all those things are maybe necessary, but they're not sufficient to maintain the health, because the communication that culture, that organizational culture has created is disempowering. It's disempowering, and it doesn't honor the employee. It sees the employee as a production unit. Although you give them all those things, they're still production units. You see the customer as a prey, where you create demand, whether they need it or not, so you can sell it. And interestingly, you see your competition as something that you need to destroy rather than something that you can learn from. Because if you destroy your competition, you're going to create a monopoly. Monopoly reduces creativity. It creates a totalitarian type of way of looking at things. So you see the implications of not living the simple life.
Good. Well said, Mario. Thank you. Mario, I'm going to use two actual examples, and I'd like for you to address both, though much of what connects them is the father figure. In one case, there is a person, this is a woman, who I have heard so many times in the way that this person talks out there, that they're always rushing out to a retreat of some kind, meditation, yogi, and yet they're an angry, bitter person. They talk about kindness, and they're extremely selfish, always judging, but never self-actualizing in a way that shows selflessness. And then when confronted, why? Why do you say one thing but do another? The idea is, well, it was my father. That's one. How do you deal with people who, when it's their choice to do something that is truly consistently positive, they're going to be consistently negative, selfish, manipulative, and greedy, and then blame everyone else for their dysfunction? That kind of reminds me of R. Stoddard when he said, we love in others what we lack in ourselves, and we be everything but what we are. So I see a lot of people thinking they're going to be perceived as a better person, and they're really into health if they go do their yoga each day. And then I see them coming outside and screaming on the phone the moment they're outside of that environment. So in that environment, they control themselves the same way at a spiritual retreat. I refused to do another spiritual retreat after 20 years ago. I did one. I met the most angry, negative, toxic people in my life. I said,
right.
Screw this. I'm not doing any more. I don't want to be around you so-called spiritual people. And then we have this other side. I know a person who comes from a historical, that old Sicilian background where the father is dominant. There is no discussion. If you're a woman in the family, you're there for specific household chores to have babies. But you're certainly not given the same credibility and power and acknowledgement and input as the son. And then if you argue, then it's almost like a battle. That person has had multiple diseases, multiple illnesses, and yet is in the health movement. And I would like for you to look at, because they both have something in common, highly dominant father figures that had a great input, a negative input in their development, and both today are living in lives that are not whole, balanced, healthy, healing, and spiritual, irrespective of what a person may say, because you, at the end of the day, it's what you actually do. It's much like America. People are much like America, foreign policy. For freedom and democracy, we're going to invade this country. Well, we've invaded over 92 countries in the name of freedom, democracy, and all we've done is create tyranny and destruction, and yet the average person is indifferent, absolutely indifferent to the consequences of our actions because they're caught up and stopped their thinking and critical analysis at the word freedom. So as long as you're conditioned to believe that freedom, much like you say, go out in the rain, get a cold, freedom means it doesn't matter what we do. We're doing the right thing for the right reasons. So don't look at the consequences. Don't look at the actions. Don't look at any other motive. Wasn't it Juan Montalvo who said there is nothing harder than the softness of indifference? Your thoughts on these two, please. These are real people, and I'm hopeful that you'll be able to give them some insights. And I've asked both to listen because I believe that a lot of what you are sharing in the area of the programming, the body-mind programming, could help them.
Yes, those are really beautiful examples that I can elaborate on something that appears to be baffling and incongruous. And I'll bring in some Tibetan Buddhist psychology on the first part so we can kind of put it in perspective. The Tibetan Buddhist psychology talks about spiritual materialism. And in the first case, that spiritual materialism, what it means is that I am more evolved than you. I am more spiritual than you because I do yoga and I do Tai Chi. But since it's spiritual materialism, they really haven't broken away from the material. So they still have the same kinds of problems, the same kind of anger, the same kind of issues. And spirituality becomes like a compulsion. And it's a material process of spirituality. Spirituality is an integrated process. Spirituality is embodied. It's mind and spirit. So if you are doing things that have to do with compassion, then you have to live compassion. And again, the Tibetan Buddhists will talk about, especially Tibetan Buddhist psychology, what they call inclusive compassion. They don't conceive compassion in any other way as inclusive. And what that means is that in the process of being compassionate, you include yourself in the compassion. Otherwise, they call it fear, or they call it behavior in order to appear that you're humble and compassionate, out of fear of not being accepted. So in that first case, I think those two are really indicators. And that person has not worked out whatever issues that person has. And another reason, too, is that we have, getting back to our culture, to our multicultural America, we support a lot of victimhood. If you were physically abused, if you were sexually abused, that's a terrible thing to happen. But you can't live with that for the rest of your life, manipulating people with that victimhood to then express your anger or to be inappropriate or to do whatever it is that you want. And it becomes your passport to be insensitive. So I think those things are really important to see. And, of course, when someone has been victimized, you treat it. And there are ways of treating post-traumatic stress, and there are ways of treating many of the traumas that people have. But if you have been victimized and then you continue to use that as an excuse to be angry, as an excuse to do whatever you do that's inappropriate, then you're basically functioning in victimhood, and that's very different than being victimized. So there are ways of dealing with it, but a lot of the, and again, the there's a movement, it's a spiritual marketing. These gurus, that, as you mentioned, will tell you how evolved they are, and then you see that they're have all kinds of issues with their anger, and they have no respect for women, and so it's incongruous. And in the second one, I think that it's related to, but I think it's not from the spiritual, but more from the what we learn. Our culture editors, I call them culture editors. These are very important people in our lives that we need and we love from the beginning. So since we need them, then whatever they do with us, we entangle what I call the intimate language of love with that. So, for example, in that second case, if the father was shaming, and the father was authoritarian and shamed that person and didn't allow that person to build a self-esteem, what that person unfortunately has learned is to entangle that shaming with love, and that person then speaks love with an entanglement of shame. And what do? They look for other people that speak shame fluently. And they can't figure out why is it that that the father follows them wherever they go with partners and friends and places where they work, because they can only speak that language. And the ways, what we do in biocognition, is we untangle that, not intellectually, but with contemplative methods and teaching the person to embody what they felt and making changes with that. We teach people to untangle whatever wound they have, and we call them archetypal wounds. Whatever, if it was a wound of shame, how do you untangle that and begin to learn, to express love without the shame component? And then what happens is a person learns that they have co-authors that they created in their life that all of a sudden they don't want to speak shame anymore, and the co-authors get upset because that's all they can speak. So you see, it's complex, but if you have the right tools, it simplifies the approach and it simplifies the healing effect. And what is healing? Cure is different than healing. And I think that most of what the life sciences are doing is they're curing, which is a temporary a remission of whatever's going on. But healing is constant. The healing is sustainable. It doesn't happen anymore. It's gone. But unfortunately, we buy cures rather than healing. And to not just blame the professionals alone, we have to look at the responsibility that patients need to take. It's not just, I'm going to help you with this and this and this, but you need to take responsibility by how you're teaching yourself to get sick. Not blame yourself, not a blaming game, but to take the responsibility to have tremendous power. You're empowered to reteach your body the causes of health, which are what's inherited, and then let go of the things that you learned. You see, it's an upside-down model of what we were taught in medical schools and psychology schools and all the life sciences. Totally inverse, but it works.
I need a real short answer because we're at the end of the program. What happens when people say they're going to change, but then ad nauseum repeat the same mistakes over and over and over again, and then expect that you should forgive them simply because, okay, well, I won't do it again, but they do it endlessly. And there are millions of people doing this in different ways each day. They take no moral responsibility for what they inflict upon other people and expect that, okay, today's new day, and then go right back at it again. How do you deal with that?
Well, the problem is that they assume that by reasoning things out, they can change. And if you could, you would say to an addict, you need to stop that drug because it's going to kill you. It's not a reasoning process, because going back to the learning of an illness, we don't learn illnesses by intellectually somebody telling you this is what's going on. By actually living it and having the felt meaning of what it is to be shamed or what it is to be honored. So then we want to change something, and all of a sudden we only take just a part of the whole bioinformational field, and it doesn't work. It doesn't change. And sometimes people will tell you, I've really tried. I've really tried to forgive, and I haven't been able to forgive. Well, they are reasoning their forgiveness. They're not embodying the forgiveness. They're not living the forgiveness, which is their ways of modifying that. But it has to be an integrated process of actually seeing what you're doing. For example, if you're totally mindless, you would be walking around, or you would go to, let's say you go out to work, and you take the long way to work, and you go through all the congestions, and then you get to work and you don't realize that you're frustrated, and then someone tells you, you might want to consider going another way. Yeah, I'll do that, but it's so habitual and so intellectual that they can't actually touch the feeling of the insight that they have power. Power is always an insight. It's always a felt epiphany. And once you have that, then you have a choice to make changes. But if you don't have that, you don't even have a choice to make changes because you're intellectualizing everything.
Or emotionalizing it. We're out of time.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Mario, for being on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We look forward to another conversation. Speaking to us from Uruguay is Dr. Mario Martinez. His website is biocognitive.com. His book is The Mind-Body Code, How the Mind Wounds and Heals the Body. I'm Gary Knoll. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour, Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. Thank you very much.